no reason to believe that there was anything illegal or improper going on.
As primary results are certified, questions are still in the air over an East Anchorage race. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 4th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hellman. Also tonight, after a weekend lost in Sitka, a stellar sea lion returns home.
They watched him for a while and saw him catch a fish, so that's a good sign.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Stronghearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
State election officials have wrapped up their vote counting from last month's primary. Now they're preparing to move on to the general election. But Alaska's political world can't stop talking about the results in one particular state house district in East Anchorage. Questions are swirling about one of the candidates, incumbent Republican Gabrielle Ledoux, and a political consultant she hired to help her get out the vote in the district's Hmong community. Election officials say they've asked prosecutors to investigate evidence of voter fraud, including 7 absentee ballots requested in the names of dead people. Nat Herz with Alaska Public Media reports on a few things you may not know about the race.
When state elections officials announce they've received a bunch of absentee ballot applications in the names of dead people, you'd think the public could figure out who's responsible pretty quickly. Turns out that's not the case, and here's why. First, the dead people are, well, they're dead. So they're not exactly telling who might have forged their signatures on their absentee ballot applications. But we also don't even know the names of the dead people. The state isn't releasing them. To Republicans who are trying to get rid of Ledoux because she caucuses with Democrats, this stuff is still an easy game of connect the dots. Here's Tuckerman Babcock, the party chair.
All signs point to the one person who benefits from the fraud, which is Gabrielle Ledoux.
There are 3 sets of facts to dig into here. Let's look at the numbers first. We already know about the 7 absentee ballots for dead people. The state also says it has suspicions about 26 more absentee ballots, all 26 of which were votes for Ledoux. Here's the thing, though. Right now, the state has released 0 information about where those questionable ballots came from, which makes it impossible to figure out if they do really connect back to Ledoux herself, or to someone she hired. Ledoux herself says she wants more information about those ballots.
I don't know what's happening at this point. I do not understand what is happening at this point. And I'm really looking forward to the Division of Elections finishing up their investigation.
That brings us to the second set of facts. They're around Ledoux's political consultant from California named Charlie Chang. Chang didn't return my calls, but Ledoux agreed to talk about him. She says a friend put her in touch with Chang nearly a decade ago. That was when she was first running for office in Anchorage and wanted help getting out the Hmong vote in her district.
First of all, I talked to him on the phone, and he knew all sorts of things. I mean, you could tell when somebody's asking you, do they have absentee voting in Alaska? Do they have early voting in Alaska? So it seemed like he really knew what he was doing, and he had relatives here.
This year, Ledoux says she told Chang to cross his T's and dot his I's because the election was going to be closely watched. But she also says it wasn't her responsibility to keep track of Chang's every move.
I wasn't, you know, I can't be doing day-to-day monitoring. All I can say is I had no reason to believe that there was anything illegal or improper going on.
Here's what else we know about Chang. A man with the same name mailed in an absentee ballot from a mobile home off Muldoon Road. So did 11 other Changs registered at the same place. That takes us to the third set of facts, around the big Hmong population in Ledoux's district. A quick refresher, the Hmong are an ethnic group from Asia, some of whom fled to the U.S. during the Vietnam War. Ledoux has a whole section of her reelection page devoted to Hmong issues. The Republicans targeting Ledoux say they're skeptical about more than 30 absentee ballots that went to people with Hmong names in two different mobile homes. Here's Babcock, the party chairman.
The number of people who applied from different trailers in Muldoon is preposterous on its face.
But Bill Wilkowski, the Democratic state senator for the area, said people should be cautious about drawing conclusions based on the numbers alone.
One of the very first meetings that I had with members of the Hmong community was I went to someone's trailer, and there were literally probably 40 or 50 people at this meeting in a little trailer. And so I do know that they have trailers where they have a lot of people living in them.
Then there are Alaska's voting laws, which Wilkowski says are relatively permissive. Remember how a man with the same name as Ledoux's consultant voted from the Muldoon Mobile Home Park, even though Ledoux says the consultant lives in California? In Alaska, you can actually keep voting absentee even after you move out of state, as long as you intend to come back at some point. That's how Dan Sullivan, who's now a U.S. senator, voted in the Alaska election in 2008. He was working as a top U.S. State Department official and living in Maryland, but he still voted absentee. Here's Wilkowski again.
There are many people that, you know, move out of state to go to college. There are many people that move out of state to take care of sick parents, and they still maintain their addresses here, and they still vote in the state of Alaska. And so if we're going to have this conversation, let's not just limit it to the Hmong.
The Elections Division says it sent its questions to state prosecutors for investigation, a process that could take months. Meanwhile, a Republican write-in candidate, Jake Sloan, announced today that he's challenging Ledoux in the general election. In Anchorage, I'm Matt Herz.
Former U.S. Senator Mark Begich announced that he's staying in the race for governor. This sets up a three-way race between Begich, former state Senator Mike Dunleavy, and Governor Bill Walker.
Alaska's never given up on me, and I won't give up on Alaska. For those that are wondering, I'm staying in this race for governor.
Both power brokers and conflicted voters have expressed concern that the Democratic Begich and independent Walker will compete for the same votes. A recent poll commissioned by the Alaska AFL-CIO found Dunleavy, a Republican, would win a three-way race by 10 points, but would lose to both Walker and Begich in a two-way race. Both Begich and Walker resisted calls to withdraw. Begich says he will fight for women's rights to make their own health care decisions. He also highlighted his support for protecting permanent fund dividends. And he says he would work to fully fund education and to reduce crime.
It's a three-way race, so get used to it. We are focusing on what this race is about, the people of Alaska. Alaskans will need to make their choice of who they will support and vote accordingly. You cannot cut a deal on your values just to make sure one person or another becomes governor.
Begich wouldn't answer any questions about how his decision to stay in the race could lead to Dunleavy winning. Begich has criticized recent cuts to PFDs made by Walker and the legislature. Walker and lawmakers said they made the cuts to help close the gap between what the state spends and what it raises in oil royalties, taxes, and fees. Both Begich and Walker said they would make up for any long-lasting budget gap with new revenue. Neither have campaigned on a specific tax proposal. Dunleavy opposes new taxes. He said he would use permanent fund earnings to pay for higher PFDs, but he hasn't said how deeply he would draw down permanent fund earnings. 4 years ago, Democratic nominee Byron Mallott joined his ticket with Walker, and the Alaska Democratic Party supported their unity ticket. Biologists successfully returned a stellar sea lion to Sitka's waters yesterday after it spent the weekend wandering down roads and into forests. Biologists with NOAA Fisheries believe the adult male couldn't find the ocean. KCIW's Emily Kwong reports on how they encouraged the sea lion's return with tranquilizer darts and some patience.
4 days. That's how long the stellar sea lion stayed on Japonski Island, an area of Sitka that houses Mount Edgecombe Hospital. A night shift employee was the first to document the animal, lumbering down a watery roadway on Friday at 2 in the morning. Sitkins warmed to the lost creature immediately, commenting online. Maybe he's heading to the bar for a couple shots. Maybe he's looking for an emergency room. But the real story is more of a mystery. Julie Spiegel is a Juneau-based spokeswoman for NOAA Fisheries Service.
Some of our marine mammal experts are thinking that it's possible that he just
didn't know where the ocean was because where he was on land was not within sight of the ocean.
The sea lion has no injuries and is 8 years old or older, weighing between 1,500 and 1,700 pounds. It's normal for sea lions to haul out of the water to regulate their body temperature, but only for a few hours, not for days. Locals were perplexed, too, taking videos of the animal sunbathing or hidden behind salmonberry bushes. The sea lion ran into the woods after being sprayed with a fire hose by law enforcement on Saturday. They were trying to encourage him away from hospital property and towards the water, about a quarter of a mile away.
And he did go quite a distance in the right direction.
The sea lion propelled forward, pushing his flippers against the grassy lawn. But the moment he got to Airport Road,
he veered off into the woods, and then he would not budge.
He stayed in those woods for the next 24 hours, visibly exhausted and hungry. He ventured a little, but never across the road. Marine mammal experts with NOAA and the Alaska Marine Mammal Stranding Network decided to sedate the sea lion and bring him home. A veterinarian administered tranquilizer darts, and Search loaned a front loader, lifting the animal and driving him on a flatbed truck to the shoreline's edge. When he awoke...
Go home!
There you go.
Come on!
Almost there.
After some hesitation, he entered the water. Responders on scene cheered.
Woo! He didn't even look back, and they watched him for a while and saw him catch a fish. So that's a good sign.
And Spiegel thanks the public for keeping a safe distance during the sea lion's four-day saga. NOAA hasn't lost complete sight of him. They attached a satellite tag to track the sea lion's movements and will look for clues about his health in the scat he left behind. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how climate change has affected polar bear movement in the Beaufort Sea.
Before 2011, you know, visitor numbers for polar bear viewing in Kaktovik were, gosh, less than 50 annually.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. You know your teenager is struggling, friends have changed, grades have dropped, and when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun, outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings. Youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings.
Four people were killed in a Parks Highway accident yesterday. Alaska state troopers report that 40-year-old Carrie Taylor Bloomquist of Palmer was driving a car that crossed the center line and hit two oncoming motorcycles near Cantwell around 4:30 p.m. Monday. 63-year-old motorcyclist Jeffrey Easley and his wife and passenger, 60-year-old Charlene Easley, both of Fairbanks, were killed. The other motorcycle's driver, 62-year-old David Fulton of Fairbanks, suffered critical injuries and was transported to an Anchorage hospital. After the impact with the motorcycles, Bloomquist's car was hit by an oncoming truck driven by Fulton's wife, 50-year-old Heidi Fulton. The second impact killed Bloomquist and her 5-year-old daughter, Adeline, who was a passenger in the car. Heidi Fulton was not seriously hurt. Her 10 and 3-year-old children, who were passengers in the truck, were injured and transported to a Wasilla hospital. Troopers say next of kin had been notified and that the accident is being investigated. A bison reintroduction project in the Western Interior has suffered a setback. The state transplanted 130 Canadian wood bison to the Lower Innoko River area near the village of Shagaluk in the spring of 2015. Alaska Department of Fish and Game wood bison biologist Tom Seaton says the herd experienced modest growth until this year.
They were up to about 140 animals in June of 2017. Then in June of 2018, we were down to an estimated 91 animals. That's about a 35% loss.
Seaton attributes the spring's fatalities to wintry weather that extended late into April, keeping forage plants buried under icy snow.
So they were burning a lot of energy trying to get to their forage and were losing more body reserves as time went on.
Seaton says most of the bison deaths were the result of poor nutrition, but wolves were responsible for a quarter to a third of the losses. Data from other wild bison populations show that only about 5% are killed annually by wolves.
Wolves took advantage of those snow conditions. So the wolves are on top, they've got full mobility, and they just get stronger and stronger by the week when they can kill pretty much what they want.
Seaton says the wolf predation was surprising. It usually takes about 20 years for wolves to start killing bison in new populations. He says this year's late spring also overlapped with the Lower Nokos herd's tendency to calve early.
We had these difficult snow conditions, these animals without much body reserves left trying to calve, and a lot of bison calves were lost when it was still truly winter and there was no forage available for the cows.
Seaton says a total of 11 calves survived, well short of the anticipated 20 to 30. He says the farewell bison, Lower Noko moose, and western Arctic caribou also had below-average reproduction rates this year.
So this was a real significant winter for all kinds of ungulates out there.
Seaton says this spring's losses are not a fatal blow to the Lower Noko wood bison herd, but a disappointing setback. He notes that natural selection will likely improve the herd's long-term health. The Lower Noko wood bison are the first to roam wild in Alaska in over 100 years. The species went extinct in the state at the turn of the 20th century, but a few remained in the wild across the border in Canada. That stock was tapped to seed the Lower Noko reintroduction project. Alaska has plains bison herds in the Delta Junction, Copper River, Chitna River, and Farewell areas, populations which originated with animals transplanted from Montana in 1928. Several startups in the lower 48 see a business opportunity amidst the proliferation of short-term vacation rentals. They're offering to help cities root out unlicensed or tax-dodging Airbnb-type rentals. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports.
The cities of Portland and Salem made eyebrow-raising discoveries earlier this month when they compared the number of licensed short-term rentals with listings scraped off the Airbnb platform. Around 80% of the listings appeared unregistered. Enter third-party vendors with names like Host Compliance and STR Helper. Newport, Oregon, Community Development Director Derek Tokos.
It helps with room tax collection because we can compare, here's who we have records of, you know, rental units, and then they'll say, well, here's some others that appear to have been rented. You may want to check it out.
Toko says Newport hasn't decided whether to sign a contract. Eugene, Lake Oswego, Gearhart, Hood River, and Rockaway Beach, Oregon, and Vancouver and Nelson, B.C. have. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium featured open positions include CMAs and LPNs for their primary care clinics in Southeast Alaska. Come work for Search and contribute to your community. Enjoy full benefits, paid time off, and retirement savings. Search is looking for someone like you. For more information, visit search.org/jobs. That's search.org/jobs to apply. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
This summer, the community of Old Harbor harvested vegetables and fruit from their farm in significant quantities for the first time. The agricultural experiment provided enough produce to sell at the local store. One employee and some seasonal helpers have overseen the project for the past 3 years. It was funded through a federal grant, which runs out soon. But as Daisha Eaton with KMXT reports, Old Harbor hopes to keep the farm going with volunteers.
Right here we have the carrots. Right here we currently got the cabbages going. And then over here we just recently got the lettuce growing.
That's Lapani Nadori, who works for the Aleutic tribe of Old Harbor, where he, among other things, oversees Nuniak Farm, which consists of two large hoop houses and a chicken coop on the edge of the village.
Nuniak is actually the Aleutic name for Old Harbor.
This is the first summer they've had the garden fully established. It even includes fruit trees, cherries and apples, and some kiwis. And...
How many chickens you got?
35 hens and one rooster.
The chickens produce about 24 eggs a day, give or take. When they stop producing eggs, they butcher them and sell them for meat. The project is funded through a 3-year grant, which ends at the end of September. The city of Old Harbor is willing to support the program when the grant funding ends, but there won't be any more funding to pay for a staff member to manage it. So they're turning it into a community garden to be run by volunteers during the transition. Eventually, they hope a community member will take the farm on as a business. Nadori says the Nuniak food market, where the food is sold, takes a small cut from the proceeds.
Once we clean off the eggs, they actually go into these 12 dozen containers, and they are sold pretty much for $4.44 a dozen. Also, we have the kale, bok choy, and lettuce that are currently for sale for 24 count, 24 leaves.
For $3.49.
That is correct.
Those prices are the same or cheaper than those paid for the same type of foods in Kodiak. Plus, they don't have to endure a barge trip or a flight, and they're fresh. The Kodiak Archipelago Leadership Institute, or CALI, helped secure the federal grant for Old Harbor through the Administration for Native Americans. The grant also helped start farms in Port Lyons, Izinki, and Larson Bay. They're working on wrapping up business plans for the farms with the villages this September, before the grant ends on the 30th. In Old Harbor, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Polar bears are technically the largest land carnivore on Earth, but they're also marine mammals. And in the last couple of decades, the Arctic sea ice has begun to vanish out from under them. So they're spending more time on land. Nowhere is this more visible than in the tiny Alaska Native village of Kaktovik on the coast of the Beaufort Sea. And while we hear a lot of alarm about how vulnerable polar bears are to climate change, in Kaktovik, changing ice conditions have created something different. Too many bears. This summer, Alaska's Energy Desk is bringing you the second season of the podcast Midnight Oil. This season, we're looking at one of the biggest challenges facing the state, climate change. Jennifer Pemberton has this week's story.
There have always been polar bears around Kaktovik, but they used to be out on the sea ice, hunting their prey of choice, ringed seals. But in the mid-1990s, that started to change. Locals started noticing more bears on shore. And researchers noticed that female bears were making their dens on land, in the snow, rather than out on the ice.
The Fish and Wildlife Service biologists started hearing about increasing numbers of polar bears on land from residents as early as the early 2000s.
Jennifer Reed works for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which surrounds Kaktovik. When they started seeing more bears on land and in town than ever before, the community asked for help. So Reed and other federal wildlife managers came in and started teaching people bear safety, like what to do if a bear came into the village and how to get it to leave without hurting it. And then in 2008...
Today I am listing the polar bear as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act.
Secretary of the Interior Dirk Kempthorne announced that polar bears were threatened in the United States, not because their numbers were declining, but precisely for the reason they were coming ashore in Kaktovik. Their world was changing, and fast. Suddenly, the whole world was aware of the polar bear's plight, and that's when outsiders started showing up in Kaktovik. Tourists who wanted to see polar bears before they went extinct.
Before 2011... you know, visitor numbers for polar bear viewing in Kaktovik were, gosh, less than 50 annually. Today, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of visitors, many from around the world each year.
More than 2,000 people came to Kaktovik last year to see polar bears. That's a major tourism boom for a town this size in a place this remote. Most of the tourists come in the fall for a number of reasons. That's when the sea ice is farthest away from shore, forcing the bears toward land. But it's also when the people of Kaktovik harvest 3 bowhead whales. At the edge of town, there's a huge pile of bones where the community has been taking their whale remains for decades. It's not safe to walk to the edge of town alone any time of year, so I hitch a ride with Bruce Inglengesik. He's an Inupiaq subsistence hunter and offers wildlife viewing tours, including polar bear tours in the fall. He says he's seen a lot of changes since he moved to Kaktovik. Bigger storms, less sea ice, more polar bears.
What are we looking at here?
This is the Beaufort Sea. The dark spots you see right here, that's the Barnard Spit. And that's where we do our polar bear viewing, all on the inside right here.
Is that where the bone pile is?
No, the bone pile is at the end of the old airstrip over here.
We drive down the old runway, a narrow strip of land with the frozen Beaufort Sea on both sides. Even in summer, the road is covered in so much snow, we can't get any closer than maybe a half mile.
I don't know how much further I can go.
Yeah. Can I take a picture of the bone pile?
Oh, yeah.
That's as close as we're going to get.
Yeah.
No bears.
Yep, and no bears. Yeah, we see them here year-round. All winter, we see them going east or west. Like I told you, they migrate along the coastline where the pressure ridges are. That's where the seals have their dens.
As summer progresses and turns to fall, the ice will be gone, and some bears will be stranded near Kaktovik until the sea freezes again in October or November. And those stranded bears are a guarantee for tourists. But not everyone is on board with the attraction. When Inglengesek became a licensed guide, he says 90% of the town was against commercial tourism.
Why were people opposed to it initially?
The community was scared about, you know, activists that was going to try to get us to shut down the whaling, subsistence whaling. But that's not true.
The tourists haven't stopped whaling, but there are still people in Kaktovik who feel like visitors gawk at their subsistence activities. It's an invasion of their privacy. Also, there's this. Late last year, Congress opened up part of the Arctic Refuge to allow oil exploration and development. That's on the coastal plain, right where Kaktovik is located. So the town is preparing for a potential oil boom. It could be a game changer for the whole region. And for some people, that makes polar bear tourism and the money it brings in seem like a drop in the bucket compared to the potential of oil. But that's months or years away. And right now, there's plane load after plane load of tourists eager to see Alaska's most iconic endangered species. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Jennifer Pemberton in Kaktovik.
That story is part of the podcast Midnight Oil, The Big Thaw from Alaska's Energy Desk. To hear more, go to alaskapublic.org or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Nat Herz in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchman in Juneau, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Deisha Eaton in Old Harbor, Tom Bonsi in Oregon, and Jennifer Pemberton in Kaktovik. Our audio engineer tonight is Wesley Early, and I'm Ann Hellman. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. Lead is bad for the health of Alaskans, especially for young children. It affects developing brains, so even small amounts are unsafe. Lead can be hiding in older paint, workplaces, ammunition, fishing weights, aviation gas, and marine paint. If you think you or your child has been exposed, ask a healthcare provider about testing. Get the lead out, Alaska. Learn more at leadfree.dhss.alaska.gov. This message brought to you by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.